at that time.
Do you think that experience, I mean, being a 14-year-old, you can't speak the language, you really couldn't even eat for a few days,
yep.
And being in this place, as you say, was a different world, do you think that that had some long-lasting effect, that those days where you were kind of in limbo, you might as well say?
I was. And I had, in those days, I had no idea where my father was. I had no idea if he would ever come to pick me up.
Right.
They wouldn't let me out because I was a minor, you know? But in effect, though, the day I arrived in the United States, I became an American citizen. You see? Because he was an American and I was a minor. And I never had to be naturalized or anything. The government... Mm-hmm. When I turned 21, the government sent me the proof of citizenship so I could register to vote.
I see.
So I didn't have to go through the same routine. I have what they call, a dual citizenship and derivative American citizenship. So, I had no idea if he would ever come for me, you know? I don't know. I had no idea what New Bedford, Massachusetts was. Compared to New York,
you
know,
you wouldn't know. Is there anything else about Ellis Island that, before we leave it, that you would say that you saw or heard or smelled or tasted anything?
I have to say that if I had known better, if I had been a little more grown up, a little older, and if I had any understanding of the language, that I wouldn't have gone through any of that, because they took care of us. They fed everybody, you know, and they, and we had a place to sleep, such as it was. I had one little suitcase that with me, that everything of mine was in there, you know, clothes change and stuff like that. I don't think, under the circumstances, let me say, I don't think that they could have done any better than they did, you know. I'm not blaming Ellis Island and the system here. It's just my circumstances. It's the way it happened, you know.
Yeah.
So, but, and when they decided to... rebuild Ellis Island, my wife and I said we have to contribute because it's an historical place.
Yes,
it has to be preserved, you know. Mm-hmm. And so many millions of people came through here, and I'm one of those that maybe had a rough time, mm-hmm. temporarily, but I survived it.
Yeah. You know? And then you went to the World's Fair.
Went to the World's
Fair. Right from here you went?
Right from here we went out, had something to eat. Then we went to the World's Fair. And that's the World's Fair that was 39 and 40. The sphere and spiral. They showed, for the first time I saw television. They showed it there. They were demonstrating it. I saw neon signs that I remember, the screwy future cars that we were supposed to get, and a lot of things I remember from the World's Fair, you know.
Yeah. Well, what was it like seeing your father, being with your father?
I recognized everybody immediately, and it was emotional. I think it was emotional for him, too. To find me here. I think if the war had not been on, he would have been at the pier when the ship arrived and taken me home. You know, that was the normal routine. Mm-hmm. I wasn't supposed to come to Ellis Island, except it turned out I had to, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And if I had not been a minor, they probably would have released me into the mm-hmm. into the city, you know, on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a minor, so.
Well, how about your father's wife? What was that like, having a,
well,
I mean, he.
She was nice to me.
Yeah.
She was always nice to
okay.
me. She knew very well, and I'm sure my father didn't have me come to join him unless she approved, because they married the same year that I came, you know, earlier in the year. And I'm sure she had to approve, you know, because they actually had to borrow money to pay for my passage. At that time, he was out of work, in fact, you know. So this was 1940, and 39, they had to send the money. And we were just starting to come out of the Depression,
yeah.
you know. And his, the mill where he was a weaver had burned down, and he was out of work for a while. So they borrowed money from a friend and to pay for my passage.
Wow.
And they were both committed to it, you know.
Okay.
But she was good to me.
Good. Okay, I'm just going to stop for a sec. Good. Okay, so the World's Fair, was that something, what kind of experience was that for you?
It was sort of overwhelming.
Yeah, I bet.
You know?
Uh-huh.
But I think what tempered it a little bit was the fact that I had gone to the World's Fair, the Portuguese World's Fair in Lisbon, that was being held at the same time.
Oh.
But it was not about the world, it was about the Portuguese world.
Oh.
You know, all the colonies, all the various provinces and stuff, they had expositions. It was beautiful too, but it was more limited to the country.
Is so, that the telegram? No.
No, I wish I had that. No, this is my medical certificate to be able to come to the United States.
Oh.
For my passage.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make copies of these papers,
sure.
if you don't mind, so we'll have
sure.
them in your file.
Oh,
and this is you as a
14-year-old?
Oh, no, that's your mother.
Oh, I couldn't find my passport. My original passport is a 14-year-old. That's my mother, but she was already sick at that time.
Yeah. She I think you look like her. Does that
yeah,
say
they
yeah,
say
you
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, okay, so you went to the World's Fair, and then what happened? You went back to New Bedford, and then told me about the school.
Right. We went to Mineola to my uncle's, and then from there we went back to New Bedford to, you know, where my father lived. Then I went through the school system, like I said, and I was in the junior high when the war started. Okay. By that time, I was a member of a soccer team that was practiced. We were practicing already to play for a club, a Portuguese club. There's like 64 clubs in New Bedford, and they had an inter-club league. I was going to play soccer for them. But then the war came, 1941, and they started drafting the members of the team. They would not draft me because of my dual citizenship. But when I saw my friends leave, I said, well, I'm not going to be drafted into the Army. If they draft me, I'm going to join the Navy. So I was 17, I joined the Navy.
Oh.
So.
What was your motivation to join the Navy, do you know?
Well, when I joined, I had planned to stay in it for 20 years or more.
Oh.
I was going to be, a sailor for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
practically. And so I joined. The Navy had four kinds of enlistments. They never drafted anybody into the Navy, even during the war. But they had, it was all volunteer, you know. They had regular Navy, which was USN, period. Those was very rigid requirements, physical and mental, because you were going to stay in there for 20 years or more. Then they had USNR, and they had two or three classes in that, USN Reserve. And you could join for 4 years, 3 years, or 2 years. Then they had USNI, which were those that were drafted by the for the Army, but chose not to go in the Army. They selected the Navy instead, so they were called inductees. They were inducted into the Navy. Well, I said, I like the Navy, and I'm going to join. I'm going to try for regular Navy first of all. Well, the regular Navy enlistment was for 6 years minimum, right out the first enlistment. Mm-hmm. So I said, if I failed the physical or anything, then I'll go to the regular reserve Navy. Mm-hmm. But I tried for the regular Navy and I passed everything. So now I'm signed in for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And this was in 1942. But I was 16 at the time. And the Navy said, well, okay, everything, you've passed everything. Go home, we'll call you when you turn 17. So when I did, they sent me orders to go in. And so I went to Great Lakes, Illinois for boot camp. And then from there I went to, Miami for subchaser training, gunnery school in Norfolk, sonar school in Key West, Florida. It's so many places. But then I was in the Navy, period. I was an interpreter for a while for Brazilian sailors that were being trained at Miami. They had about 300 Brazilian sailors that we were training to take over our ship, the ships that were built here, and they'd sail them back, you know, for patrol and stuff like that. So I was interpreting some of that part of the time. They wanted me to stay, but I wanted to go to sea med, so I asked for sea duty. Then I got on my ship, USS Schmidt. And then again, see, it was USS Schmidt was the name of my ship. I picked it up in Quincy, Massachusetts, and stayed on it for 3 years or more. So the the ship was named. You want to continue?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The ship was named for the first Catholic priest that was killed in the war. Oh. He was killed in Pearl Harbor, and he saved 12 sailors. He lost his life, but he pushed 12 sailors out of porthole, and he couldn't make it himself. So my ship was named, but it was a German name. And every time we'd say, I'm from the USS Schmidt, you know, they
look at us
a little bit funny because it was a German name. But then I served on the Schmidt in the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, the Mediterranean, North Africa, Murmansk convoy out to Russia. We were in the invasion of Normandy. Then before the Germans, they were beat. They were before they collapsed, actually. They took our ship that brought it to Staten Island to be converted to an amphibious destroyer transport.
Oh.
At that time, then, after it was converted, we went to the Pacific. So, in the Pacific, what we did was underwater demolition, the frogmen.
Oh.
We were all retrained, became amphibious sailors. And in the Pacific, I cannot not even remember all the names of the places that we were at, but we were in Saipan, Aniwetok, Myokojima, Kokaijima, New Guinea, so many mm-hmm. places.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were in the invasion of Leyte in the Philippines. We were took part in that. And during that invasion, we had a problem with our boiler room in the ship. It broke some tubes or something. And so they said, well, you can't stay in these operations. You got to go back to Pearl Harbor to be repaired.
Oh.
So they sent us back to Pearl Harbor, but in Pearl Harbor, after the Battle of the Philippines, there were so many ships damaged, Japanese and American, and all the facilities were being used to repair capital, what they called cruisers and other more important ships than ours.
I see.
Mine was a destroyer escort. So they sent us to the West Coast, to San Pedro, California, which is the port for L.A. And they put us in dry dock to fix the ship. And one day, I'm on duty. I'm actually the petty officer on duty. And all the ships in the harbor start blowing their horns. And I didn't know why. So there was civilian workmen working on the ship. And I said, what's everybody blowing their bullhorns for? Oh, didn't you know the Japanese surrendered, gave up? So I said, oh, gosh. And we don't have a horn because we were in dry dock, so we didn't have any steam or anything on the ship. So I said, I got to have a horn to blow.
Yeah.
So I went and searched. I knew we had an emergency horn that you could pump, you know, air horn.
Oh, right.
Pump. So I found that thing, and I'm up on the bridge blowing our horn, too. So,
wow. So so you were in the service, in the Navy, for how long then?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah. I had joined for 6 years, but at the end of the war, they said, don't anybody that was 17 and joined for 6 years and had so much sea duty, so much, you know, duty in combat areas,
could leave.
Ask for a reduction to 4 years.
I see.
Minimum. I had to serve 4 years.
Yeah.
And by that time, I was married, had a wife and a son, so I said, well, this is no life for my wife and son, so I decided to leave the Navy.
So did you marry while you were in the Navy?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And how did you meet your wife?
We were in the seventh grade together.
Oh.
Yeah, we met in the seventh grade, and we were also neighbors. We just lived about two streets away from each other.
Yeah.
So, and when I went in the Navy, I had my orders to go to report to Great Lakes. They gave me a little potty at her house, okay? And with some of the boys and girls that we had gone to school, all school chums. And we had some games and stuff And spin the bottle was one of them. So we kissed, and then I went in the Navy, and we started writing. I was in boot camp. We started writing together, and they got more involved. You know, in more every time we wrote, we became a little more serious. But we also went to junior high. I was beginning junior high. She was already in her second year of junior high. Because of my starting late, she was a little ahead of me. And she was a musician, played the violin. And she played, and actually she was 14. She was already playing in the symphony orchestra in New Bedford. Mm.
That's wonderful.
So, and she would take over the junior high orchestra, lead the orchestra when the teacher was not available. He'd pass it on to her. So we got closer, and every time after boot camp, I came home, we started going together, and then I was assigned to my ship, and I was doing convoy duty. And we were fighting German subs all the time. And we got married. I was 18, and she was 16. She had just turned 16, wow. You know? And we had promised the parents that we would wait until we were older, till the end of the war. But the longer, the more we kept in touch, the more we realized we don't have any idea how long this war is going to last. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to, even if I died, she wanted to have something from me. Mm-hmm. So we decided to have children right away,
oh.
You know. So our son was born, and when he was born, actually, I was retrained out in Virginia for the new ship that they were converting. But after the, well, that's, you know, we got married. We have had a boy and a girl. The girl is Barry's, married Barry. And they have three sons and four grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and beautiful kids. And, of course, Barry's Jewish.
Oh.
You didn't know that?
No.
Oh, yes. In fact, Orthodox Jewish.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. 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 And it was never any... when they met in college, and they started going together, and then to regress a little bit about them, with us, we never had any problem with anybody's religion or ethnicity or anything, and we taught our children never to be that way. But Barry's mother expected Barry to marry a nice Jewish girl.
Sure.
So she was very upset. Yeah. But we got together. The parents got together. In fact, his father came and says, you know, Rose, his wife, is very upset, and I don't know what to do about it, you know. And I said, Bob, I said, if they're really serious, what can we do? I said, I've talked to both of them, and you cannot deny love, you know. If there's, so it's up. I don't know how to help your wife, but if they're serious about it, we might as well accept it. So they did. Mm-hmm. They accepted it, and we became very good friends.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Let me go back to your Navy days. How, when you look back on those 4 years, How did that experience, how do you think about that time spent during war in the military?
I always felt, from the beginning, I felt that I had to do everything I could for my country. And I accepted the fact that I was a citizen here. This was my country. And I had to do everything to defeat our enemies, to help defeat our enemies. We were involved in many scrapes, many situations where we shouldn't have survived. But we did. We were attacked by kamikazes. We were torpedoed. We had a route around Iceland and Greenland, North Atlantic, where we'd go for days without eating because they couldn't fix any food. The ocean was so rough. They couldn't. We had to go without. So, in all those 4 years of going through this, we always felt that the ship was named for Father for Chaplain Schmidt, right. And he was watching over his own ship, you know, watching over us. And we still feel that way. We still have reunions.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I organized the first one in 55, 10 years after the war was over. And my wife and I have organized two or three others, and we didn't go for the last two because we weren't healthy enough. But they have another one now this month. I don't know if it's in Florida. I don't know if we can make it. But we're still all the shipmates that are surviving. We're losing them every week just about now. But those that are surviving, we're still in touch with each other.
That's wonderful.
And everything. By the way, my ship was the first ship in Japan after they gave up. Uh-huh. That's something. Mm-hmm. When the Japanese gave up, and everybody's blowing their horn in the harbor, right after that they refloated us, or they put us back in service, and we brought the whole crew back, and there's an experience I have to tell you about, but then we went to Japan. We were in Japan 5 days before MacArthur came to make preparations. There were our ship and another ship, like ours, with underwater demolition teams. We went to Sasebo, Japan, which was 30 miles from Nagasaki, and we were there 30 days after the bomb was dropped there. So that whole area was contaminated. We didn't even know. The Navy didn't even know about those things in those days. Mm-hmm. But we were there to make preparations, make sure that they were serious about surrendering and they wouldn't fire on our ships when they came with the troops and so on. So everything went fine. When we this is an aside thing. When we came to San Pedro, California, to have the ship repaired, by that time we were already training for the invasion of Japan. We had been training off Maui in Hawaiian Islands already, and we knew we were going to be the first ships in, the first people in, to clear the obstacles for the troops to come in, because that was our job, underwater demolition, the frogman. And we also knew that not many of us would be able to survive, because our team, Team 18, were the team that cleared Omaha Beach in France, and 38 of them went in to clear the beaches, only 6 came back. So the risk was very high. So when President Truman dropped the bombs on Japan, we could kiss his feet. because we knew it gave us our life. You know, to us, that's what it was. Not that anybody was unwilling to do their job. So when we got to the States, we were under very, very strict orders not to write anything home, not to tell anyone, not to call anybody, and let them in any way know where we were, because we were doing this very secretly. So, but when we got to the States, in California, I called home, called my wife, and I said, I can't tell you where I am, but if I am in any way able to get any kind of leave, I will call you and we'll meet somewhere in the middle of the country so we can just meet each other. So that's all I told her. So she didn't wait anymore. She figured, well, if you call me, you got to be in the United States. So she took, all she knew was that she used to write to me, care of the Fleet Post Office in San Francisco, California. So she took off, went all the way to California, and she had a heck of a lot of trouble, because in those days, all the train coach seats were reserved for military. They were all numbered and reserved for military use only. But she was able to team up with a soldier, and he somehow, I guess, told the conductor or something that it was his wife or something. She got to California, San Francisco. When she got there, she didn't know what to do, so she went to the YWCA to stay. She had one suitcase with her. And now she went to the Red Cross. She went to the Navy office there. She went to every place she could figure to find out where I was so she could go and meet me. But because of our secret standing, even the Red Cross could not find out from the Navy Department where I was. So they kept, trying. They tried everything. And the Red Cross kept saying, he must be under very secret, because we can't. Even the Red Cross can't find out, and that's something. So, but they arranged something. The Navy said, well, okay, we'll do this. Tell her to get on the train from San Francisco, mind you, and go to L.A., and go to the intersection of such and such a street, and wait at that corner.
Oh, my goodness.
Honest to God, that's... Wow. So... In the meantime, my captain got orders for me to be able to get off duty, to go to the L.A. and be at that intersection, such and such a street. Neither of us knew anything about meeting, you know?
Right.
So I go to that intersection. I thought I was being put on shore patrol, because I had done shore patrol, too. And you report to someplace, they gave you an armband and say, well, you're... For the next 4 hours, you're taking care of sailors that get drunk, you know. So I get to that intersection, and it's like this. And I'm at one corner, and I'm waiting for somebody to come and give me orders or something. And I look over to the other corner, and there she is, my wife, standing there. So we had only 4 days together. And at that time, you could only stay in a hotel, registered in a hotel, I think, for 4 days, the maximum. Then you had to leave, because it was the military had preference, you know. So she had to keep moving, but 4 days later we were on the way to Japan, you know. So she's left all alone there. She didn't have her suitcase. She left it with a friend at the YWCA in San Francisco. She thought L.A. was next town, you know, but it's a long distance. So she didn't have anything with her. And so she had to stay there, and she got a job in a restaurant, a waitress, yeah. And she was shifting hotels every 4 days until she could get enough money to come back home. And, you know.
Oh, my goodness. What was your wife's, what is her name, and what was her maiden name?
Her maiden name is Alice Ferreira.
How do you spell it?
F-E-R-R-E-I-R-A.
Okay. And we're let's just conclude. I know you mentioned before we started the interview that you did photojournalism.
Oh, yeah.
That was your job. Yeah. And say the paper that you did that for.
The Manchester Herald.
And that's Connecticut.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Manchester, Connecticut. In fact, I still have my press pass. It's still valid, actually.
Well, why don't we conclude here? I mean, I'd like to see that, too. But with your saying, what has brought you a lot of satisfaction in your life?
Mostly my family, the family that that we have. My wife, children, grandchildren, all nice boys. People like Barry, who's a wonderful person. And my great-grandchildren now. And the fact that, see, my education was interrupted by the war. But at the end of the war, I had 4 years of college coming to me.
Oh.
So I took advantage of it. That's how come I wound up doing this. Oh, my great-grandchildren, Barry's great-children, grandchildren.
I don't think you actually answered the question about when you look back on your Navy career, how has it affected you? How do you feel about that period?
Well, I feel like I did my duty. If more had been required of me, I would have done it again if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It was a hard experience, but very satisfying.
Can you say anything about wartime and how people are when they're faced with such extreme circumstances in life and death?
Wartime, if it could be outlawed, but it can't, should be outlawed. It's the most horrible kind of experience on the world, anywhere. There should be better ways of doing things. War should never happen, no matter what. The things I saw during the war, what it did to families during the war, it's just abhorrent. It's terrible. I don't believe that there's a military man that served during the war that it was not against the war. Mm-hmm. You know? There might be, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But if they had any war experience, they would be turned off on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. my press pass, yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, very nice.
Well, I retired as an editor.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd like to put that in your pile of things to copy, too. That's
okay.
Very nice. Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say before we close? About coming to this country, about living and serving in World War II for this country, Ellis Island, anything that you would like to say?
Gosh, there's so many things I'd like to say. But,
it's been a wonderful interview. I thank you for that.
Well, you can't deny, you can't deny that for personal freedom and many other things, this is the greatest country in the world. And I've been to quite a few. But it hurts me. It hurts my feelings every time I see a law that is passed, whether it's local, town, mm-hmm. state, or federal. Every time that they pass a law, that it tells me it's restricting personal freedom, it hurts. It hurts. Because I fought for the personal freedom, you know? And I think they should, before they pass a law, mm-hmm. they should say, look at it. Is it enhancing our freedoms or taking away our freedoms? And it should never be anything taken away. There's no reason why they can't pass laws to protect society without restricting freedoms, you know? So these are the things I think about. This country means a lot to me, you know, and I don't know how else to say it except that we should protect it all the way through, every day, if we can, okay. You know?
Yeah.
So my brother, I have a brother. I didn't mention him before. My brother is from my stepmother.
Right.
So he came late. He's a year older than my son, actually. That's all. And he is of a different, of course, different generation. Both he and my son served in Vietnam. Mm. My brother was, he retired now. He's from the military. He's a colonel, retired colonel. But when he went to school, I think because of my father's influence of languages and stuff, he decided to become a linguist. So he went to the University of Massachusetts and specialized in Russian and Slavic languages. So he speaks like five different languages or more. And because of his specialty being Russian, he became important during the war, during Vietnam and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. And he, at one time, he's got a PhD in languages. At one time, he was teaching Russian languages at the University of Florida.
Thanks.
And he lived in Maryland. He lived in Tallahassee at that time. And as I understand it, the way he explained to me is that the University of Florida and the government had made an arrangement so that they could teach military officers, army officers at the university, you know, in languages and stuff. So my brother was the lone professor that had to go with the arrangement. So he was teaching there. Then at that time, one time he calls me and he said, brother, I have to ask you something. Said, I'm going to be working, I'm going to go to work for another branch of the government. Is there anything in our background that might be embarrassing or something? And so at that time, I said, look, I worked with secret stuff in the Navy. You know, as a sonar man. So they never that was secret by the mm-hmm, Navy. Mm-hmm. And since I became a photojournalist, I've been cleared and investigated by the Secret Service so many times that they must have quite a file on me, because I was cleared to be at the commissioning of the Nautilus, the submarine Nautilus, which was very tight security in those days. Mm-hmm. I said, I've been cleared to be with, be next to every president that ever visited Connecticut. And they had to send my name in. My paper had sent my name in to Washington every time to be checked out before they sent credentials for me to be with the presidents. I said, so they have a good file on me. Don't worry about it. But they also investigated our father, and they investigated the whole family. Because one time we're camping, my wife and I are camping, and we come home. This was after he asked me this. I come home, and my next door neighbor says, did you do anything? Because there were two people here asking a lot of questions about you, you know. Uh-huh. So, you know, that's...
Yeah,
that's my life. But he's still working for that branch of the government.
Wow. And how did you feel when your son went to Vietnam?
I'll tell you, I, in a way, being a father, I felt some anxiety. But I told him right off the bat, at the beginning, I said, Ronnie, that's his name, you've received so many benefits, so many good things in your life from this country, that this is little bit that they asked you for payment back. Mm. So it's your duty. I told him that. I explained the benefits and the things that you receive here, you can never pay back. Mm. But this was a little bit of payback that they asked him to do. So... he accepted that. He went, and he had quite a... He went to OCS, too, mm-hmm. Officer Candidate School, because he placed so high on the tests. That's another experience. When he finished high school, he goofed off in high school. He never came home and did any homework. And I'd ask him, don't you have homework from school? He said, yeah, I did, but I did. I had a book report or something I did during study period. It's all done. I turned it in. It was so easy for him, yeah. You know? So when he graduated, some of his friends were going in the Navy. So they had to go to Hartford to take the tests, you know, and the exams. And he went with them. Mm-hmm. He had thought about, because I was Navy,
yeah.
He had thought about the fact that he might go to the Navy.
Yeah.
But he hadn't committed.
Uh-huh.
So he went to Hartford to be with his friends while they were taking the test. And while he was there, the examining officer So I'm sitting there, and he says, how about you? Aren't you going to take the test? And he said, oh, no, I just came with my friends. I said, well, as long as you're sitting down, why don't you take it anyway, find out, you know. So he sat down with him. He took the test, the same as the others.
Yeah.
And next thing, we get a call from the recruiting officer in Hartford. He says, we can't believe it. Your son came was just to be a standby with his friends. We got him to sit down and take the exam. He says he not only finished 15 minutes ahead of time, which nobody is supposed to finish, you know, in time. It says the exam is designed so that you are not able to finish in the allotted time.
Oh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
That's part of the figuring. He said, but your son not only finished 15 minutes ahead of time, he got the highest mark we've ever had here.
Goodness.
So now, this is the recruiting officer. I already talked to my people, and we're ready. We want him to try for Annapolis. Said, and we feel that he's definitely officer material. So we wanted to him to try for Annapolis. And if he should fail from Annapolis, we're ready to offer him a 4-year full paid tuition for any school of his choice.
Wow.
And at the end, the only commitment is that he's committed to giving his 4 year of service as an officer, you know, in the Navy.
Right.
So when I talked to him about it, I said, Jesus, free school,
yeah,
4 years, an education without the need for them. And they also the books and everything, plus a little subsistence they had, a little allowance. Well, okay, you know, he talked, he said, I'll think about it. Well, you're going to try for Annapolis first. My grades in school are not good enough to go to Annapolis. So he goes to school and he has a session with his counselor. His counselor was a lieutenant in the Navy Reserve. And when he looked at his record in school, he says, you're not good enough to be an officer in the Navy. Completely discouraged him. So he comes home, he says, no, my counselor said, no, I can't make it, so I'm not going to go. So now he waits, he's drafted into the Army. He goes to Fort Dix in New Jersey, and he takes exams again. Again, they call us. He's officer material. We want him to go to OCS. He would not go because he didn't want to commit. He wanted to serve his time and get out.
Right.
You know. So he would not go. So Fort Dix sent him to Fort Benning, Georgia, where the Officers Candidate School is. Anyway, and in Fort Benning, his commanding officer called us at home to convince him to do it. Says, we've been talking to your son. We're trying everything we can. We don't understand why he rejects going to Officers Candidate School and so on. So I told him the reason. I told his officer, his commanding officer, the reason is because he doesn't want to commit to so many years of school and then so many years of service. I said he wants to do his duty, serve his term, and get out. So he said, oh, is that why? Well, then maybe we can arrange something. They got him up that night. They talked to him all night, and they told him, if you don't graduate from officer candidate school, you don't have to serve the extra time, you know? So now he accepted. He goes to officer candidate school. Then he had a medical problem, and they wanted to fix his medical problem, and he said, no, he had got spasmodic ankles. And he got hurt in high school playing football, and that came back on him. But anyway, he said, no, I want to get my hitch over with. So he goes to Vietnam. They sent him to Vietnam. Because of his background in officer candidate school, he became the adjutant to the general commanding
general. Oh, my gosh.
So he was flying around in his helicopter. He had some experiences there too, but
all right. Well, I think we can end here. We actually went way over, but that's okay.
Yeah.
And you've really given a wonderful interview, and I'm very happy to have
it. Thank you.
And I'm gonna make copies of these papers.
Okay.
And then we'll have those on file, too. I've been speaking with Reginald Pinto, and this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm signing off.